Those of you who have been here over the past few weeks will know that we are working through John Wesley's general rules. Do no harm, do good, practice those practices that keep us in love with God. Now, we're right in the middle of the first of those, do no harm. Last week, we talked about doing no harm to the self and made the distinction between self-love and selfishness. They're not the same thing. In fact, selfishness is the enemy of self-love, because self-love means to care for the self the way God does, because we know we're a beloved child of God. Once we're able to do that, it frees us up then to love other people, not for what they can do for us, but because they are beloved children of God just like us. And so we are to our second step in examining do no harm to others. Well, you can't go through this life without doing some harm, I hate to tell you. Sometimes it will be unintentional. Other times we get defensive, or we get our feelings hurt, or we just feel particularly like we want to strike out, and it's on purpose. Now the question is, how can we do as little harm as possible? When United Methodist clergy are ordained, we're asked a couple of questions that are a little startling to most people, and we're supposed to answer yes to those questions. First of all, they ask us, are you going on to perfection? We're supposed to say yes. You recognize at least this preacher hasn't reached it yet. But that's put in the context of the second question. The second question is, do you expect to be made perfect in love in this life? And we say yes. To be made means it's not our doing, it's God's doing. It's God moving us along toward what? Being perfected in love, which means loving the way God loves. Doesn't mean we ever cease to make mistakes. Wesley never suggested that. We move toward not hurting people intentionally. That's moving toward perfection. Had a bishop a number of years ago, Bishop Tullis, who said, well, if you're not going on to perfection, where are you going on to? What are you aiming toward? That's where we aspire, to love the way God loves. And we continue to fall down, and we depend on God's grace as we hope to move ever closer to that great love. Last summer, I got to meet a unique, in my experience, pastor, a Lutheran pastor from Denver, Nadia Boltz Weber. I got to hear her speak here in Nashville at an event. Nadia has an interesting story. She grew up in the Church of Christ, left the Church of Christ to go, I guess you would say, to the opposite end of the spectrum, where she rejected all religion pretty much, thought it was all a lot of bunk, and then slowly moved her way back toward, I guess you would say, the center, because she's a Lutheran pastor now. She's not your typical Lutheran pastor. If you saw her on the street, you would probably not mistake her for one. She has tattoos all up and down her arms. She does not dress in clerical garb except when she's conducting worship. She lived a life that took her through alcoholism and recovery, a journey that took her through rejecting the church to finding God. She said that what she realized along the way was that in the church of her origin, people fit into two buckets, one of two buckets. You were either saved or you weren't saved. Those were the two buckets. She said, when I left the church, I thought I had thrown away those buckets, except what I discovered was I still had them with me. I just put different people in them. Because I was liberal, there was a liberal bucket and a conservative bucket, and I liked the liberal bucket. Said, what I finally had to recognize is that there aren't buckets. not in God's understanding. That God's grace is over all people. She's written a book called Pastrix. It's a weird word, and it's her reclaiming a word for a female pastor. And the subtitle is The Cranky, Beautiful Faith of a Sinner and Saint. She formed a church in Denver called The House for All Sinners and Saints. And it's an eclectic group of people who gather there. She said at one point she was a little disturbed that too many ordinary people were being attracted to the church. And then she had to catch herself because there again, there were two buckets. The weird people who were attracted to the church and the ordinary people. They were just people, and God's grace was over all. God's grace was over all. The source of doing harm, it seems to me, is when we start dividing people into buckets when God has not done so. God doesn't make that kind of division. The other image of that comes from Bobby Ann Mason, a writer I like very much. A few years ago in The Atlantic, she was commenting on a controversy or a conflict between two writers from the same region. And she used an image that's fairly familiar in the Appalachian region, because if two farmers can't come to an agreement on where their land meets and they can't come to an agreement on a single fence, they will sometimes build two fences, each one building their own fence. That space between those fences, she reminded them, is called the devil's lane. Because it signifies that we couldn't find common agreement. We couldn't find common cause. We couldn't work towards some common good. Sometimes the devil's lane runs right down the middle of the church. Sometimes the devil's lane runs right down the middle of society. Sometimes the devil's lane runs right down the middle of Congress. Sometimes the devil's lane runs right down the middle of the entire creation. And there's a reason it's called the devil's lane. Jesus tells a story that's helpful here, although it's a troubling story on the face of it. Najah says that the traditional name, the workers in the vineyard, is not an appropriate name. She says it's the story of the landowners, because the workers are not really the focal point of the story. It's the landowner who represents God who is the focal point of the entire story. Jesus said there was a landowner who had a vineyard. He went out early in the morning to hire some workers for the vineyard. He found them. He promised to pay them one denarius, which is a day's pay in the ancient world, what you need to live on for a day. They came, they started working. A little bit later, mid-morning, he went out and he got more workers. Went to the square and brought them in, said, I'll pay you what's fair. Went back out in the middle of the day, found more workers, brought them in, said, I'll pay you what's fair. At the very end of the day, an hour before work is about to be finished, he goes back to this gathering place in the square, and there's still a few people there. He says, what are you doing hanging around here? They say, nobody would hire us. Nobody wants us. He says, come, work for me. I'll pay you what's fair. When the pay is actually given, Jesus reverses the usual order and pays the last ones hired first. They're each paid a denarius, a full day's wage, though they worked just an hour. Those who were hired at midday paid a denarius. The ones who were hired in the early part of the day are now rubbing their hands together thinking, if those yahoos who just worked an hour get a full day's pay, just think what we're going to get. We're going to get maybe two or three. They get to the end of the line, and those who worked all day, the landowner gives them exactly what they had contracted for, a denarius. Well, they're angry. They say, look, these people who work just an hour get the same pay that we do. That's not fair. There's nothing fair about that. And the landowner says, how much did we agree that you would work for? They said, a denarius. He said, how much did I pay you? A denarius. He said, are you telling me I can't be generous with what's mine? See, God's grace doesn't depend on how long we've been working. God's grace doesn't depend on how well we work or how smart we are. God's grace is there for us, embracing us. And that's troublesome to those of us who have lived in church all of our lives and put up with preaching all of our lives and suffered through worship services all of our lives. And for what? See, we've had God's grace all along. It's a gift. It's not something we can earn. That's what allows us not to harm others. It's not our own goodness. Heavens knows if I depended on my own goodness, I'd be sunk. No, it's God's grace that moves us ever closer to loving people the way God loves. It's something we can participate in, but not something we control. How do we know if we're doing harm, not doing harm, doing less harm than we did before? Well, Jesus also gave us a barometer for that. That's found in another story. In that story, Jesus summarizes the end of it by saying, what you have done to the least of these, you've done to me. I think that's the barometer. Whether or not we're doing harm really is based on how our actions and decisions affect those who are most vulnerable, those who can't pay lobbyists to protect their interests, those who don't have any power within the culture, those who are pushed to the margins, left out, shunted aside. He gives some specific categories. When I was hungry, you gave me food. So whether or not we're doing harm depends on when people are hungry, do we give them food or do we take away what little they have already? When I was naked, you clothed me. When people need clothing, when they need warmth, do we offer those clothes or do we just shake our heads because of how they look and how they smell? When I was a stranger, you welcomed me. Do we welcome the stranger, or do we have our buckets ready to put those strangers in the other bucket? Not our bucket, the other bucket. Sorry, God's thrown the buckets away. When I was sick, you came to me. Are we going to allow everyone to have the same kind of medical care that we enjoy? Or are there certain people who deserve medical care and certain people who don't? Do no harm. When I was in prison, you came to me. Are we going to write those folks off and say, forget them, they did something terrible, they deserve what they're getting? They may have done something terrible, okay? They may need to be locked away for a period of time. But you know what? We also have done some pretty terrible things. Maybe not murder, but remember what Jesus said? You've heard that anyone who kills a brother or sister is liable to the law. I tell you, anyone who calls a brother or sister a fool. Uh-oh. Ouch. Is liable to the law. You heard in the lesson, God has given us everything we need. Not to do harm. And then it's up to us to follow what God is doing. Following God's lead in caring for those that no one else cares about, or apparently. Throwing away our buckets of us and them. Because we're all in this together. And how do we do that? Well, the practices are outlined for you. Make every effort to support your faith with goodness, and goodness with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with endurance, and endurance with godliness, and godliness with mutual affection. Mutual affection. Isn't that what we're aiming toward when we throw the buckets away? But there's one more step. Add to mutual affection love. To love the way God loves. And the only way we can do that is with God's help. We're not talking about the kind of perfectionism that you experience in the world. No, that's the enemy of loving the way God loves, because it depends on how well we do, how well we perform. If we extend God's love, if we practice these practices, growing ever closer to loving the way God loves, if we use Jesus as a barometer of avoiding doing harm, then we are well on our way to being made perfect in love in this life. We are well on our way to doing, if not no harm, as little harm as absolutely possible. Thanks be to God.